This is the second day of this July 7-day Sesshin of 2011. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu. Before we get back to those, I did dig up some biographical material on Yuan Wu. Not a lot, but it'll give us a little bit of a profile of him. This I'll be reading from the Encyclopedia of Asian Philosophy and Religion. Again, as we said yesterday, he lived in the 1000s and 1100s. I'm reading here, he was one of the most important Chan masters of his time. With masters like him and the 20 years younger Mumon, so they were contemporaries, Mumon, that's the Japanized version of Wu Men. So with masters like him and the 20 years younger Wu Men, Chan reached the last peak of its development in China before the Dharma transmitted by the patriarchs was brought to Japan. There it continued to flourish, while in China it gradually declined. Probably the most famous disciple, Dharma heir of Yuan Wu was Da Wei, the great Da Wei, who is credited with having reformed the Rinzai lineage, Rinzai tradition in his day. And then much later, a few hundred years later, in the same lineage, same Rinzai Zen lineage in Japan, was Hakuin. So there's kind of a thread that runs down with these famous names, Yuan Wu, Da Wei, and Hakuin. As we said yesterday, Yuan Wu is best known as the compiler of the collection of koans known as the Blue Cliff Record, or the Hekigan Roku. And just a little here, Yuan Wu was the son of a family from Sichuan province, the heads of which had been Confucian scholars for generations. And as a child, he learned the Confucian classics by heart. This must have been a tremendous feat. But there are others too, other masters we've read from in Taisho who had the same beginning. And also this, he was attracted to Buddhism at an early age and entered a Buddhist monastery where he devoted himself to the study of the sutras. I know that's at least half a dozen of these great masters that I've read about in Taisho had the same, much of the same kind of upbringing. Confucian classics, attracted to Buddhism at an early age, and then beginning his monastic career with a study of the sutras. And then now, after nearly dying from an illness, he came to the conclusion that mere scholarly erudition could not bring one to the living truth of the Buddha Dharma. And so he set out to find an enlightened Chan master. He went to South China, and there he eventually found and stayed with this master Wuzhu, Wuzhu Fayan. And he served as his attendant for many years. And this is interesting. Even after he had realized profound enlightenment under Wuzhu and had received from him the seal of confirmation, he stayed with him to train further until the master's death. That's a sign of someone of humility and great commitment. The more common thing these days here in North America is once you get your papers, then you're off. Then he set out for the north, where he was appointed by high state officials and finally by the emperor to the abbacy of various large Chan monasteries. Conquest of North China by the Khitan drove him once again to South China. However, he soon returned to his home province and was active there as a Chan master until his death. There was so much civil strife in China for hundreds of years, and like Yuan Wu, there were teachers who had to travel hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles to escape the hostile forces. All right, we'll go back now to our text from yesterday, a book called Zen Letters, Teachings of Yuan Wu, translated by the Cleary Brothers. Our last sentence that we read yesterday was where this is a letter, these are all letters, where Yuan Wu is saying to the recipient of the letter, "You are half drunk and half sober and unable to clean all this up. Frankly speaking, you simply must manage to keep concentrating even in the midst of clamor and tumult, acting as though there were not a single thing happening, penetrating all the way through from the heights to the depths. You must become perfectly complete, without any shapes or forms at all, without wasting effort, yet not inhibited from acting. Whether you speak or stay silent, whether you get up or lie down, it is never anyone else." I'm reminded of a very short koan in the Mumon Kan. It goes like this: Shaka and Miroku are servants of another. Shaka, of course, refers to Shakyamuni, and Miroku refers to the Buddha of the next world cycle, Maitreya in Sanskrit. So the Buddha of this world cycle, the Buddha of next world cycle, are both servants. This would be so baffling, if not provocative, to the Confucian hierarchical mind. They're both servants of another. Who is this other? Of course, he's talking about our self-nature, our true nature. But it needs to be, the response to that question needs to be demonstrated in Doksan. Just to pick up a few things here from what we just read, you must manage to keep concentrating even in the midst of clamor and tumult. This is quite an advanced state of absorption to be able to do that, but it's not out of the reach of anyone here. We don't really get a chance to test ourselves in Sesshin with this wonderful quiet that we're immersed in, but we sure do after Sesshin. We get back to all of the clamor and tumult of our busy lives. Penetrating all the way through, from the heights to the depths. In Sesshin, we take this roller coaster ride. It can seem like sometimes the heights of of can be euphoria to the depths of discouragement. And if we just persevere through these ups and downs, through the smoother sailing and the storms that we are confronted with, if we just persevere, we see that none of these amount to anything, because we see that they all pass. They're just weather systems. This is what Sesshin veterans figure out eventually, but which new people can be more challenged by. You must become perfectly complete without any shapes or forms at all. Obviously, he doesn't mean this literally. Without any shapes or forms. This is referring to the sense of expansiveness and limitlessness that we come to experience in more advanced states of awareness. Without wasting effort. Wasting effort, you can say, plays out on two ends of a continuum. The continuum is that of exertion and surrender. And the one extreme is to get all tied up with tension and working on one's practice, straining. That's the one extreme to avoid. The other extreme is to passively just wait and hope that something will happen, but without really making any real exertion. That's another extreme to avoid. And they both waste effort. To get our energy flowing, we need to avoid both of these extremes and find a way to work. To try to describe it is really foolish, because it's really best described negatively, to avoid straining and to avoid passivity, to be attentive, really. That's what it all comes down to, of course. To be attentive, bringing one's whole awareness, attention to the practice. But that doesn't have to be with straining. He goes on, if you become aware of getting at all stuck or blocked, this is all false thought at work. And so, yes, we find ourselves from time to time in Sesshin feeling stuck, feeling blocked. And you can be sure that there is some kind of thought processes that is causing that. It may not be an actual discrete thought, thinking about something in particular, but it is some kind of crust of thought activity in the mind. It may not even be aware of it. a student just today described Mu as pure energy. And it really is. Mu, which is just another word for our true nature is pure energy. If you distinguish it from thought, energy and thought are pretty much inverse proportion to one another. If we have a lot of thought going on, a lot of thoughts in our mind, we're not going to have much energy flowing. And if we have a lot of energy in our practice, we're not going to be troubled with thoughts very much. So if we feel blocked or stuck, we can be sure that it's some blockage of our natural vitality, and that happens if you're as long as you're in good health, then that happens through thoughts. And when we find ourselves blocked that way, the only thing we can do is just try to reach a deeper absorption in the practice without straining. This is a phrase that is quite often used in the Chinese text by the Chinese masters that I haven't noticed in the Japanese Zen text, is this speaking of energy, conserving energy or wasting energy. Really, it's just talking about when you're conserving energy, you're detached from your thoughts. You're not involved with them. And wasting energy is when you are. Again, Sesshin veterans know that late in Sesshin, the energy flows in a way that it rarely does, if ever, early in Sesshin. Early in Sesshin, we've got all of this resistance from thoughts, this weight. It's really a kind of a weight of these persistent thoughts that we haven't found our way beyond yet. That's why drowsiness is reported far more often early in Sesshin than later. He goes on, make yourself completely untrammeled, like empty space, like a clear mirror on its stand, like the rising sun lighting up the sky. Moving or still, going or coming, it doesn't come from outside. What is this other? Let go and make yourself independent and free, not being bound by things and not seeking to escape from things. Just to this one sentence, let go and make yourself independent and free. So he's using his teaching is here as in command form. Let go, become free, become independent. Well, that's not so easily done. We can't just make up our minds to be free, but we can make up our minds to get more thoroughly immersed in the practice, and that's how we become free. That's how we become more independent, untrammeled. It's not by thinking about it as a goal, but it's always the same. It's always through the practice, absorption in the practice, that we get free of our thoughts. Not being bound by things. Roshi Kaplo used to quote Hyasatani Roshi as saying, the Zen person is not bound, nor does she bind. Not seeking to escape from things. No doubt there are at least a few people already in the Sesshin who've had thoughts of escape. It's not so surprising when we're struggling with pain and thoughts to have the mind flit into a thought, you know, hopefully very briefly, about wanting to just get out of this place, if it's the last thing I ever do. But the way to get out of it, of course, is to get into it, really get into it. And we learn by hanging tough, by sticking with our commitment to stay here and to keep working, we learn that incredibly valuable lesson that if you want to get out of things, get into them. We find it, then we can use that through our direct experience of going through this in Sesshin. We find that it becomes so valuable in our daily life and things we get into, maybe social things, social commitments. Who hasn't had that experience of having agreed to go to this event or that event, a wedding shower or this or that, or and you feel you can't get out of it. So what do? Well, you find a way to become one with it. Because to want to escape from something and just be miserable while you're there it's masochistic. If you can't get out of it, get into it. Well, it's easier said than done when it's a situation that we don't like. But that's where this practice is so useful. Sesshin is never just about Sesshin. This is training the mind, training our mind bodies to overcome aversion, what we don't like doing. And to just flee is no real solution, because there are so many things we have to do that we don't want to do. So we find a way to get into it. We find that the way to do that is learning how to direct our attention. When we find thoughts of resistance or dislike coming into the mind, well, we have a choice, don't we? We have a choice to have our attention on those thoughts. Oh, I wish I hadn't. Why did I come here? Why didn't I? You know, just replaying these tired old tapes of regrets and kicking oneself, and that's not working. The other choice means just putting our attention, which means engaging fully with what we're doing, where we are. It's so much more intelligent to work with our aversions that way. Yeah, He goes on, from beginning to end, fuse everything into one whole. Where has there ever been any separate worldly phenomenon apart from the Buddha Dharma, or any separate Buddha Dharma apart from worldly phenomena? In other words, this is the Buddha Dharma. The pain in your knee is Buddha Dharma. Sneezing is the Buddha Dharma. Crying, laughing. It's not the Buddha Dharma, so-called, isn't some rarefied, separate place. It's just this. Just say a little more about working with pain, because it is such a prominent feature of some people's early days of Sesshin. It's really very simple. Just to say a little bit more. When we're in pain, physical pain, the worst thing we can do is think about the pain, let ourselves dwell in thoughts about the pain, which usually means thoughts about ourselves. Instead, the way through the pain is to become fully one with it by becoming one with the breath or the koan, whatever our individual practice is. It's that simple. It's always the same solution to whatever struggles we're having in Sesshin, is go to the practice. And not just halfway, but with everything you've got, pour yourself into the practice. And in doing that, we become one. We're no longer separated from the experience of the pain. That's where the trouble comes, is when we separate ourselves from the pain. What that means is, separating means having thoughts about it. It's not just the pure experience of pain. It's thoughts about it. So when we're having pain, if we go to mu, the pure energy of mu, then, all right, there may still be some pain, but now our relationship to it has changed. And that's all we have to do. We don't have to banish the pain. Very few people are able to do that in Sesshin, but we don't have to. We just have to have our relationship to it changed. We relate to it differently. We're no longer being oppressed by it, menaced by it, dominated by it. Instead, we're aware of it. We're not denying it. We're aware that it's there inside of a kind of a tenuous kind of way. But it isn't a problem. It's not an obstruction if we are really absorbed in our practice. From time to time, I hear beginners say, well, why do we have to sit in these difficult postures? The answer is simple. It's because these postures, where either you're sitting cross-legged or your legs are drawn in closer to the center of your body, kneeling position, that these postures enable us to get more absorbed in our practice. They enable us to concentrate more effectively. Some people find that they just have to go to a chair in order to concentrate on the practice. But for most of us, if we can avoid using a chair, then we're going to be able to get more, sit more effectively. To pick up here with Yuan Wu, this is why the founder of Zen, Bodhidharma, pointed directly to the human mind. This is why the Diamond Sutra taught the importance of human beings detaching from forms. Well, the primary forms that we have to detach from is our thoughts. That's really the essential way of detaching from forms. When we learn to detach from our thoughts through absorption in the practice, then we find ourselves more free of every kind of form. To develop this essential insight, it is best to spend a long time going back into yourself, at Zazen, and investigating with your whole being so that you can arrive at the stage of the genuine experience of enlightenment. Spend a long time going back into yourself. The essence of this practice that we there's the form of it, of facing the wall with our legs crossed, but the essence of it is detaching from objects that we see, that which we see as outside us, turning the mind back into yourself, as he says. So in terms of conflict, just social conflict or other kinds of problems that arise in groups of people, it means not primarily trying to locate the blame, the cause of the conflict outside yourself, but to turn your mind back and say and ask, okay, what? How am I contributing to this? What am I bringing to the table with this conflict? This could change the world if people would practice this. Because our impulse, our reflex, like a knee jerk, is to look to others. It's their problem. It's their fault. Such a radical leap in evolution to not to deny, not to ignore that they may have their responsibility, yes, but our job, each one of us, is to look back at how we may be contributing to it. That's the practice of contemplative meditation. We do it formally facing the wall, but then we can exercise that tool all the time. He says this is what it means to practice with boundless, infinite, enlightened teachers everywhere in every moment. A saying in Zen, everything is Buddha. Everyone is Buddha too. In every circumstance, whether a conflict or not, in every circumstance, we have the possibility of being taught by it, or by him, or by her. Then he finally says, strive sincerely for true faith and apply yourself diligently to your meditation work. This is the best course for you. Strive sincerely for true faith. Faith, it all really comes down to faith. Faith in the purity of our inherent nature. That in our true nature, nothing is lacking. And faith in the practice, the method, and the actual practice of the koan or the breath or whatever. Whatever problems we encounter in Sesshin or outside Sesshin, it's the same solution. Detaching from thoughts about it by becoming more thoroughly engaged with, if you're sitting, then with the breath or the koan. If you're not sitting, if you're out and about, here or there, becoming there too, free of thoughts and completely engaged. If your practice is a koan, then you just stay with a koan, whether you're sitting or not. If your practice is the breath, then to wherever you are, whatever you're doing, to just be one with that. Not trying to follow the breath, but being one with it. Okay, our time is just about up, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.